This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, an extraordinary event, if not game, at St James's Park. The atmosphere, the unfortunate fancy dress, the early goal, the cameras constantly trained on the curious new owners and Dec and Ant, a life saved in the crowd, and then everyone remembered Newcastle aren't very good. Elsewhere, Leicester beat Manchester United in a great game. Tielemans, Maddison and Vardy make statues of Ole's boys. Mo Salah aims to be the only player you can vote for in goal of the month. Wolves stage an astonishing comeback at Villa. Edward Mendy saves Chelsea and Southampton get their first win. Also today, a goalkeeper decking his own teammate. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Good morning.
Hi, Max.
Jonathan Wilson. Hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
Nick Ames, how are you?
I'm very well, Max. How are you?
Well, I'm very good, thank you very much. And joining us, our Newcastle correspondent. Is that your official title, Louise Taylor?
Northeast correspondent, but sadly the other teams in the Northeast have rather faded away. So it is mainly Newcastle at the moment.
Well, don't rub Barry and Wilson's nose in it that early in the pod. Let's start then. At St James's Park. Johnny Liu wrote an excellent piece about this game, saying talking and writing about football is about telling stories, prioritising and editorialising, finding out what matters and filtering out what doesn't. But what mattered here and in what order? How do you begin to even process a day of such sad and unspeakable strangeness, a day with no maps, no anchors and no real precedent? Louise, you were there. Did it feel like that?
Yes, Jonathan's piece is brilliant. I mean, it's a bit like, sometimes match reporting is a bit like an English comprehension test that you used to do at school. And this was a particularly tricky one, how to prioritise when you're doing the match report. I mean, it was really a really strange day. I mean, at first, when they scored, I mean, the pictures, you could imagine the TV images playing incredibly well in Saudi with the huge excitement. And then there was this horrible incident where the fan collapsed. I mean, happily he was stable and recovering in hospital last night. But the game stopped for 20 minutes. The players went off the pitch. I mean, hats off to Eric Dyer, who came racing across the pitch asking for a defibrillator. I mean, the Spurs players were about to take a corner and they spotted what was going on behind them in the stand, alerted by the fans. And they were really, really quick and smart thinking, because everyone else in a way seemed frozen, understandably, not knowing exactly what was happening. But I think particularly Eric Dyer really, really latched onto it.
Yeah. I mean, it was a strange day, Wilson, wasn't it?
Yeah, a very strange day. And yeah, that first 2 or 3 minutes, you sort of thought this wave of euphoria was going to carry Newcastle to a result that wouldn't have been expected a couple of weeks ago. And then it just sort of fell apart in a kind of hilarious way. The other thing, I found the strips really hard to tell apart on telly. Was that just me or was it just...
I didn't.
Okay, maybe it was just me. But repeatedly, somebody would be breaking and they would appear to have a player, you know, outside them. And then I'd look again, it'd actually be somebody from the other team. So I found it a very confusing game to watch just on that level. So that, yeah, the whole thing felt really weird, and the fact the camera kept going back to you know the director's box with Ant and Dec in the wrong order, which was also disconcerting, and Staveley and Romain behind. So every reaction, they must have known as well. So every reaction felt like they were acting out what the reaction ought to be.
You mentioned Eric Dyer there and Reguilón as well. Richard got in touch to say, can you give some praise to the Newcastle fans who saved the fans' life during the game yesterday? They were working on him for 10 minutes before the game was stopped. I don't know if that's exactly what happened, but if that's the case, absolutely.
Well, my understanding, Max, is that there were several Newcastle fans helping them, fair play to them, and a Dr. Pritchard from North Tees A&E was on hand to administer CPR, I think. There's footage of one of the Northeastern reporters, I think Scott Wilson, if I have his name correct, posted footage today of him sort of being congratulated after the event, presumably when the fan was stabilised. So well done to all concerned.
And, you know, it raises the importance. I thought David Ginola spoke incredibly well about that kind of incident on Sky and the importance of defibrillators, and probably worth pointing people in direction of the Justin Edinburgh 3 Foundation, obviously in memory of set up by his son, in memory of Justin Edinburgh, who died after a cardiac arrest. Onto the game. That, Louise, that second minute when the goal went in and the atmosphere before the game, it sounded incredibly noisy on the television. When that goal went in, what was it like?
Well, it was delirious. I mean, as I said in the match report, there was sufficient sort of, it was so electric, there was probably sufficient power to keep the lights on in the northeast all winter. I mean, it was almost delirious, semi-hysterical. It was strange. There'd been a lot of Geordie nostalgia beforehand with Jimmy Nail songs, and I mean, it was a real celebration. The script was going according to plan, but there's so many flaws in the midfield and defence. And I mean, you have the ridiculous Jonjo Shelvey sending off. I mean, he'd only just really come on, and he got booked and then booked again, and off he went. So it was a kind of emblematic, almost a microcosm of Newcastle's flaws. That's sort of the latter part of the game.
They're not very good, Nick, are they? And they're in this weird position now where, I mean, by January, Newcastle could be in an absolutely terrible position where, like, no player would want to go there. And I'm not really sure what manager would want to go there. I started to think they're going to have to start offering really weird bonuses to the current squad, like enormous amounts of money just to get 3 wins or something in the next couple of months.
They're in a very sticky position for a newly taken over club that is, you know, as we think, the richest in the world, aren't they? And I think it'll be quite a come down for the owners if they're scrapping out with, I don't know, Rotherham and Luton in the Championship next season. And it is hard to see how anyone really makes it that much better in the next, let's say, 3 months, 2 months until the transfer window, with this squad, because it's not that good, with the exception of players like Sam Maximin, who Louise mentioned, and Callum Wilson, if he's fit and firing. There's not a great deal there. And you do think that by January, they might have almost too much to do. So then what do the owners do? Do they splash out £100 million and try and do this, that and the other? Or do they suck it up and think, OK, we're going to have to pull this back from a really low base? I'm sure they'll get over it, but it's an interesting start, isn't it?
How do you see it playing out, Jonathan?
Well, yeah, I think it becomes a two-stage process, doesn't it? That their job now is to stay up, and you can think of what they might want to do in 2 or 3 or 5 years' time, but that's not what they've got to do now. The immediate job is get the players in to get them fourth bottom or better. I would imagine getting rid of Bruce, almost whoever you bring in, will create at least a short-term little uplift. I don't know if Louise has heard any more on this, but the name that keeps being mentioned is Eddie Howe, as somebody who's available. But, I mean, really, how attractive is Eddie Howe's relegation battle? Who are you going to get in? And, you know, we know from Sunderland the problem of, you get to January, you're desperately in trouble. You have to bring in 4 or 5 players. You have to pay them over the going rate. And then the economic decline spirals, because you've got a squad of players who are getting too much money. You cut it back at the end of the season and you get yourself back in relegation trouble the next year. So it's a difficult position they're in. And I also think, you know, this was the perfect game for them, playing Tottenham. So, you know, big name. You're beating Tottenham, sounds good. You know, it's Tottenham. It's not, with all due respect, Watford or Brighton. They're a big name. And they're a big name team playing quite badly with a centre forward who hasn't scored for 20 years or whatever it is, and they still can't beat them. And they get the early goal, and they still can't beat them.
And actually, Barry, I mean, Tottenham were quite good in this game. They were actually there, which most of the coverage didn't seem to notice. And Tanguy Ndombele was brilliant. And, you know, there are going to be Premier League players who play every game this season that we don't mention once on the pod. I sort of feel this is a guy that we'll keep mentioning because he's lots of fun, and he was superb, and he can be absolutely useless, and he can be brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, he got absolutely slaughtered, I think, after the North London derby, when he didn't play particularly well against Arsenal. You know, not many of the Spurs players did. He was superb yesterday. I like watching him, but he is incredibly erratic. I think he would actually fit in quite well in that Newcastle side, I think. You never go know what you're going to get with him. But Spurs were mightily impressive yesterday, but Newcastle were so off it. I mean, it must have been a very strange day for Newcastle fans because everything had changed, but everything was still the same. And they just basic levels of fitness. They don't look fit. And, you know, they were clearly surfing a wave of adulation and optimism and jubilation in the opening 5-10 minutes. But then it was almost as if, oh God, we're tired now. We're not even halfway through or a third of the way through the first half. So it was an impressive performance by Tottenham. I thought when Newcastle went ahead after a minute and a half or whatever it was, oh yeah, they're going to win this. There's no way they can lose. But I hadn't sort of factored in the fact this is Steve Bruce's Newcastle and they're just not very good.
Louise, how have you found covering the whole story? I notice you're not on Twitter, which I think is a great idea, probably. I just wonder how you've sort of found the last couple of weeks.
Well, it's been crazy. It's been head spinning because so often in football, we've been talking about this takeover for so long, and then it happened out of the blue. And then suddenly all the local journalists were at Desmond Dean House at a hotel in Newcastle, you know, having audiences with Amanda Staveley in her suite, and it was just all happening. And I mean, there's been so much, there's conflicted emotions because of the human rights angle. I mean, as Sir Bobby Robson said, it's all life is shades of grey. It's not black and white, and this is seriously a sort of shades of grey. And it's a weird story to cover because it operates all sorts of levels, at the geopolitical level, the human rights level, the northeast level, and it's the football level, which is a big part of it as well. But you know, sometimes it seems strange to be sort of writing pieces about who's the next manager, how much are they going to spend, when there's bigger issues at play.
There are definitely, I don't know how many people on this pod, I got in trouble for saying I wanted them to get stuffed on the radio. I would find it quite funny, as John Bruin said, if they just didn't win any games for the whole season. Right, well, we'll move on to Leicester Man United. Louise, thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Louise Taylor there, the Guardian's Northeast football correspondent, i.e. the Newcastle United correspondent, with apologies to Barry and Wilson.
To be fair, Maxi, because Sunderland and Middlesbrough are no longer in the Premier League, her brief has been extended to include Leeds as well.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Let's go to the King Power. Leicester 4, Man United 2. Wilson, you were there.
Yeah, it was a brilliant game. I really enjoyed it. And all the problems we've seen all season were there for United. And Leicester, I think, were a lot better than they have been so far this season. There's two things going on. They've been bad through midfield. I think the organisation midfield has been poor all the time under Solskjaer. I mean, they're fine if they can just sit back and absorb pressure, but as soon as they have to do any pressing or any sort of cohesive build of play, they're just not at the level of organisation that very top clubs have to be. And Ronaldo's exacerbated all of that. So Leicester, again and again and again, just played through their press. Sumare for Leicester, who's a player that I'd never seen live before, but he was excellent alongside. I mean, Tielemans obviously was the man of the match, but Sumare alongside him was really good. And I think you've got to give Brendan Rodgers credit for going to the back three for the first time in the league this season. And what that meant was the wing-backs were able to engage United's full-backs, but particularly Luke Shaw, very high up. So Luke Shaw was not involved in an attacking sense. And having the two centre-forwards of Iheanacho and Vardy running around the outside, you know, in the channels between the fullbacks and centre-backs, caused United all kinds of problems. Plus, you had James Maddison sitting exactly in the area where United are weakest, which is at the back of their midfield. And so Leicester just sort of picked them apart. But then you have the thing that United do actually have some really good players. So suddenly, Greenwood scores a goal from nowhere. And that was one of those goals where it was directly in line with the press box. You knew as soon as he struck it, it was going in. And that was a great shot. And Leicester had started the better. And you think, oh, well, you know, United have got away with this. But then the pressure builds again. Leicester get back into it. They go ahead. And then United score another brilliant goal through Rashford. you know, great ball from Lindelof, great first touch, great finish from Rashford. 10 minutes to go and you think they've managed to spawn another lucky point or lucky win. And then they still couldn't hang on. You know, Leicester just swarmed all over them again. And Vardy's finish for that third goal was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, Solskjaer afterwards.
Oh, sorry. And the other thing that would worry me, quite apart from the midfield.
Is it Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager of Manchester United? I don't know if you've thought of that. You could write an article about that.
you're getting terrific mileage out of that article.
Yeah. I mean, the longer they keep him in the job, the more I can just spew that out over and over. It's my weekly Ole knocking piece. And then I'm getting, why are you pursuing a vendetta against Ole? I'm not. I'm saying exactly the same thing over and over again because it isn't changing. But I think where it has got worse is they can't defend set plays anymore. So they've now let in 4 goals in the league from set plays already this season, 2 on Saturday. But you could see every time Leicester got a set play, there was panic. United weren't well enough organised to deal with it.
After the game, Solskjaer said something's got to give. I didn't think he would be the one to say that. Slightly, he should have kept that.
Well, Pogba said it as well.
Pogba did say it as well, yeah.
Which, that interview, it's, I mean, you know, things have to change. What things are you thinking about there, Paul?
Nick, can we talk about Yuri Tielemans' goal? Because it was so beautiful, wasn't it?
Oh, it was exquisite. I think I've watched it about 15 times now. I mean, it's just a bit of a shame that Harry Maguire had such a nightmare leading up to it, because afterwards, the conception and the chip, which you never ever see a finish like that now, do you? A sort of, you know, delicate, floated finish that takes about 5 minutes to nestle in the top corner. And it was just a game of great goals, really. Like, I think I loved every single goal in that game. Even Patson Daka's slightly fudged tap in at the end, because that was a nice moment for him. He's a very promising player who I think they hope in the next year or so might become the new Vardy, you know. So no, Tielemans' goal was the absolute pick, although Vardy taking that glorious slice out of it on what I think was the half volley, although we could be here for another 6 hours talking about that one.
That was definitely a half volley.
Well, Matt says, further to your discussion about the half volley, does Jamie Vardy's goal fall into that category? Was the ball already rising? I think it is a half volley. I think it is.
Has to be a half, right? Yeah. What else could it be?
Well, it could just be a strike.
I think it's right at the end, or basically half a second longer. It's not half
of the normal distribution of half volleys. It's, yeah, you're right. It's not right in the sweet spot, but it hasn't risen totally. You know, there's a point on the rise where it's no longer a half volley. Not a volley either, just a strike. Yeah, we all agreed on that?
Yeah.
What do you call it when it's got beyond that critical point, though? A strike?
Yeah.
You're hitting the ball.
Is that the agreed
terminology? You're hitting the ball on the bounce. Well, it's not agreed, but it's clearly correct to say that that's on the bounce. There's volley, half volley, striking it on the bounce.
I think you can strike a ball on the volley, and that's different to a volley, because I think if a ball's bounced and it's really high, you're not sure, Wilson?
I think you're introducing...
Was Ben Chilwell's a volley then? Or on the bounce?
If it's bounced up 20 metres and then it's coming down and you're levering it, how is that not a volley?
How much air are you putting in the ball, Nick, for it to if it's bounced 20 metres?
I watch a lot of League One football, Max.
Oh, yeah, we came back from 2 down, didn't we? Good result for us.
I don't know which game you're talking about. I'm sorry. Course. I was watching another game.
Well done to Joe Ironside there in the 88th minute. Anyway, Christopher says, do you think United should expect more from Ronaldo than tap-ins, tantrums and skip desserts for £400,000 a week? Paul, who's harder to dribble past, H. Maguire or H. the hologram from Red Dwarf? I mean, I would add H. from Steps in that as well. They're sixth in the table.
So Maguire, to be fair to him, I don't think he was fit, was he? You know, he had he's coming back from a calf problem. He looked tentative on his feet, and while he probably should have reacted quicker in the move leading up to Tielemans' goal, it's a really bad pass from De Gea.
But he did just wait. I mean, if the pass is bad, you can't just say, well, it's a bad pass, I'm just going to wait for it to get to me.
But I think his wait was there to receive a pass and then move forward. And then, I'm being overgenerous, but I think because of his issues with the calf, he then wasn't able to readjust his weight quickly enough. as Iheanacho nipped in.
Well done, Leicester. They looked excellent in that game. Manchester United have defended the decision to fly to face Leicester City for the game. The club said they took the decision based on operational circumstances. United say they do a lot to reduce carbon emissions. Our mate Justin Morehouse said the only thing we did defend yesterday was doing that. Manchester United announced in July they were teaming up with Renewable Energy Group Inc., a leading producer of renewable fuels with a shared mission to tackle climate change and create a greener world. According to Google, it's an 18-minute flight. It is 1 hour 43 on the train, but you do have to change at Nuneaton. You look confused.
An 80-minute flight?
No, 18.
Oh, 1 8, okay. Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Happy with that?
Well, it makes a lot more sense. If it's an 80-minute flight, I'm just wondering which way they're going.
The other way round the world.
That's quite a long haul in comparison to Arsenal's 15-minute flight to Norwich a few years ago, isn't it?
Absolutely right. How long in a 15-minute flight as the seatbelt signs off? It's everyone, you know. It's like bing, bing. You've got not a lot of time if you really need a wee.
The air steward or stewardesses must do like a serious trolley dash.
They're just lobbing nuts, aren't they? Just lobbing the nuts down. That's all the time they've got.
So my other thought from that game is, given how Leicester troubled United with that 3-4-1-2, and given that's pretty much the shape that Atalanta play, you can see Zapata and Malinovsky having all the fun that Vardy and Iheanacho had. So that would be a concern for me for the Champions League this week.
I note that Atalanta, I think, scored 4 goals yesterday.
Only against Empoli, but yeah.
I'll steal all that for my television work. Thank you, chaps. And I will not attribute it. That'll do it for part one. Part two will begin at Vicarage Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Watford 0, Liverpool 5. Adam says, after claiming that Ethan Pinnock had already scored goal of the season.
I knew this was coming.
How does Barry feel that Mo Salah has achieved this feat twice since then? Nick, you were at this one. Liverpool were fantastic. That Salah goal was just, it was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was even better than Ethan Pinnock's, actually. I was stunned. I was there, and it does feel like every Salah appearance at the moment is a bit of an I was there moment, I think. And the remarkable thing was that there were so many narratives around this game, weren't there? There were Ranieri's return, which he bodged, in my opinion, which we can come to. Sadio Mane getting his 100th Premier League goal, which on its own is a sensational achievement from a brilliant player. There was Bobby Firmino scoring a hat-trick from a cumulative range of 2 centimetres, and all of that just upstaged by a player who is producing, I think, some of the best football I've seen in the Premier League, in the Premier League era. Absolutely. We can go through the goal. It was kind of a slightly slower motion, if you like, version of the Man City goal, but more intricate. Like, there was a moment, I think he had 4 players between him and the goal, and he kind of stopped and rolled his foot over the ball a couple of times and just lost 2 of them. They chops back, and Craig Cathcart does that thing that always embarrasses a defender, where you slide in and end up totally off camera. And then you've only worked a half chance on your left foot. You've still got to pick your spot, and he picks it, and it was just incredible. And I think Klopp said afterwards, you could see that our players knew they'd seen something special by the extent of the celebration, because at that point, it made it 4-0. The outcome was academic, and Watford had their first shot on goal a minute later. So there wasn't much riding on it, but it was sensational. As was the ball with the outside of his foot that covered about 40-50 yards to Mane for the opener, which was absolutely absurd. And Liverpool were utterly embarrassingly dominant for the entire game, until the last 20 minutes when Watford kind of remembered that they were playing too. I think Watford had their first shot in the 55th minute, straight after Salah's wonder goal. Juraj Kuka had a 35-yard shot that Kelleher, the standing keeper for Liverpool, saved, and there was ironic cheers and applause all over Vicarage Road, which didn't really bode well for the tenor of Claudio Ranieri's tenure, I think. And I think Ranieri, we have to cut him a bit of slack for a game like that, because I think Liverpool would have beaten pretty much anybody. They were so slick and on song. But Ranieri turned up, made four changes. A couple of them were very debatable. One was to play Danny Rose as a left centre back, which was
He had a sad day. Danny Rose had such a sad day, didn't he?
It was a bit of a niche move. I mean, when my team's lined up like that, I thought, oh, okay, he's put Rose there because, you know, there's not going to be much in the air. He's fairly mobile. Salah's pretty immobile, apparently. So maybe that's been done for that reason. But within about 3 minutes, Salah had done him twice. And then directly before the pass to Mane, Salah just completely rolled him on halfway. Rose overcommitted, basically. And that was disastrous. He also played Sarr down the middle when it was quite clear that Watford weren't going to get a lot down the middle in that game. Far better to use the flanks and the channels. And Sarr, 18 months ago, or you know, several galaxies ago, had absolutely destroyed Andy Robertson, hadn't he, in that game where Watford won 3-0 and Nigel Pearson was being serenaded off the pitch to the tune of Bad Moon Rising and all this weird stuff that you have to pinch yourself to think ever happened before the pandemic. And you think, why not do the same again? And Sarr was just never in the game. Watford were never in the game. They were totally passive. It didn't even produce any of the sort of token blood and thunder that you might expect of a team under new management against a top side. And I think Ranieri, he's got to get a grip quickly. It sounds a bit harsh, but you can't make too many more missteps like that. I think he did get that selection wrong. And Watford looked a little bit forlorn. Also, I've got to make one admission, which is that I looked at the team sheet at the start, and okay, I was on holiday for a week either side of the transfer deadline, but I looked and I saw Moussa Sissoko playing for Watford, and I thought, oh, I did not know that he had gone there. And I shouldn't admit this, should I? But I just thought every time I have visited Watford in my last 5 or 6 years, it's that club, isn't it, where you look at the team sheet and you go, oh, him. And it was Moussa Sissoko for me this time. That had totally, totally bypassed me. And the game totally bypassed him. So there we go.
A lot of chat about whether Mo Salah is the best player in the world right now, Wilson. Does it matter? Is he? Should I care if he is or not?
I mean, I'm always uneasy about overpraising individuals. But if we have to, I mean, who's better right at the minute?
Salomon Rondon, of course.
I mean, Salomon Rondon's, I think, has had a slightly creaky start to Everton. I wonder whether Rondon might be over the hill.
Sam Avery, the comedian, messaged me. We had him on the radio yesterday. He said, Rondon looks like he's running in jeans, which I thought that was quite a nice line.
Benzema, maybe, but I think probably Salah, yeah. I mean, I guess another way of putting the same question in a slightly less celebrity-driven way is, if you were given an unlimited pot of money to set up a new MLS franchise, who would you get in to play on the right side of your front three? You'd get Salah, wouldn't you? And you'd be prepared to compromise other positions to get him. So, yeah, he's playing brilliantly.
Barry, who were you going to suggest? Ethan Pinnock?
Ethan Pinnock. I'm sure we'll get to Brentford and their wonderful performance presently.
We will, but not quite yet. We'll do Villa Wolves next. How on earth, Barry, did Wolves win this football match?
I think Aston Villa lost it rather than Wolves won it. And I don't mean that as an insult to Wolves. Villa were complete control of this game. And then Dean Smith made some, well, with the benefit of hindsight, ill-advised substitutions. They let Wolves back into the game. Connor Cody scored a goal. That's how bad Villa were in those closing 10 minutes, because he doesn't get too many. And, Wolves took their chances. It was a real smash and grab. They probably deserved it, but Villa, I would say, lost the game rather than Wolves winning it.
Can I say that if we're talking about passes this weekend, the pass from, I think it was Neves to Podence for the first goal of Wolves in that game was absolutely sensational and almost rival Salah's. I think a set piece had been cleared and he had about half a split second to take it down and think about what to do. And he angles it through to Podence. He's making a totally blind run. who then crosses it, and I forget who scores. I think Saez maybe.
Saez.
And I think the only way that Neves let himself down there was it wasn't with the outside of his foot. But otherwise, it was absolutely sensational, I thought.
I enjoyed how the equaliser and the winner were both satisfyingly shit. It would make me even happier as a Wolves fan. I don't want two glorious 30-yard volleys. I want, you know, two in Zabi sort of fell over and Cody just, he couldn't, literally couldn't miss. And then that free kick is absolutely agonising, isn't it? Just because all the Villa players can see it going in, but none of them can do anything about it. And they just stood so helpless going, oh, we've messed this one up.
I thought it could have been avoided because Matt Targett was sort of turning his back to the ball, which is unforgivable, really.
Completely.
And that is, I say unforgivable, I'd probably do it too because I don't like getting hit in the face.
I'm not sure you'd jump, would you, Barry?
I'd probably be the draft excluder.
What a draft excluder you'd be. Brentford 0, Chelsea 1. Wilson, Chelsea were lucky to win this game, weren't they? Edouard Mendy was absolutely superb.
Yeah, he made four or five really good blocks, and then the one he tipped on the bar was a brilliant save. So I think, was it seven shots on target for Brentford, one for Chelsea? So, I mean, I don't know. Chelsea at the minute, I feel they're in that one of those spells where do you look at them not playing well and say, this is a worry that you know the results are better than the performances, or do you assume they'll snap out of this and they've actually done well to get as many points as they have in a pretty rocky patch? So, yeah, Brentford, again, were excellent. Definitely deserved more at the game. And Chelsea got away with it. And they're very fortunate that Ben Chilwell can't miss at the minute.
And was I the only person who was wrong about Edouard Mendy? When he arrived, he was obviously better than Kepa. But then I thought he had a real touch of the Ariza Balagas. And I've been categorically proved wrong. Did anyone else?
No, I'm with you. I assumed he was... I mean, he's clearly one of the best three or four keepers in the league. I assumed he'd be, you know, at best a sort of mid-ranking Premier League keeper. Because I mean, he was only 26 million, something like that. So he wasn't sort of a hugely expensive sign. He wasn't, to be honest, somebody who'd sort of really sort of registered, you know, my brain as a potential signing for anybody. But no, he's good with his feet and he, you know, he makes saves as well now.
And there was one pile driver from, I think it was Pontus Janssen, that just went straight into his face and really hurt.
Yeah.
And that was probably a bit fortuitous, but Matt Targett wouldn't have saved that.
No, you're right. Everton 0, West Ham 1. Barry, Declan Rice in this game was so match of the day too. I think Danny Murphy sort of pulled it apart and just showed how good he was. And also showed how good he is at every part of being a midfielder. You know, he's not just a holding midfielder. He's not just an attacking midfielder. He can do all parts of it.
I haven't seen Match of the Day 2, but if it's enough to get Danny Murphy enthused, it must have been a brilliant performance. I'll be honest, I was a Rice skeptic, and not because I was mildly irritated at him for turning his back on Ireland and signing up for England, but you know that's a totally understandable decision on his part. I'm very impressed with him as a bloke, and now I'm increasingly impressed with him as a player. He's good in defence, good going forward. He's very elegant. His gait is he reminds me a little of a racehorse or a thoroughbred racehorse. The way he just canters, covers the ground. And he's still very, very young. Presumably, he won't stay at West Ham, but he seems happy there at the moment, and they're very lucky to have him, because if he was out, I think they'd miss him terribly.
He's become so important that it's going to be interesting to see how Moyes uses him now. Because I think he's played him in both of the Europa League games so far, which they've won well, and he's been fantastic in both of them. But certainly, after their last game, which I think was against Rapid Vienna, wasn't it? I went 3 days later to see them play Brentford and they lost. And that midfield was a bit flat. And you kind of thought, maybe for the next three or four games, because they're going to get through their group, I'm sure. you might have to duck him out a bit. I know he's important. I know it's a privilege to be in Europe for West Ham and stuff like that. But I think the kid gloves might have to cut them to come on a bit in order to avoid the sort of eventuality Barry mentioned, which is that you don't want to be losing him for a period of time because he is that important to him.
Would he be the answer or a very large part of the answer to Manchester United's problems? I think they should probably try break the bank to try and get him.
Yeah, I mean, they wanted to get him in the summer, and the message that came out was that they didn't want to make three big signings along with Varane and Sancho in the same transfer window, and then they go and waste the money on Ronaldo instead. But he wouldn't. He would make them better. Clearly, he is a better footballer than Matic or Fred or McTominay, but you still have to put him in a structure that works. And I think that's one of the reasons for Sancho's problems, that Sancho is used to, you know, Dortmund, he was used to a very, very defined attacking structure and defensive structure. And he's now being asked to find his own way and he's struggling to adapt to that.
Danger, danger. Jonathan Wilson's writing the article again. He can't help it now. Every answer will just revert to that the rest of his life. Sitting in a home when he's 92, and they ask him if he wants what he wants for breakfast, and he'll get onto why it's not working under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Jordan Pickford got some criticism in this game for being outjumped by Antonio, which led to the corner, which led to the goal. But more interestingly was that he had all the notes for the penalties on his water bottle. Did you see this? He had Mark Noble and where Noble had put the penalties, Declan Rice and Antonio, I think it was, where he'd put the penalties. Mojo says, with Pickford covering his bottle with West Ham penalty info, next match should he just go full hog and have a flip chart or a TV and video recorder hooked up to an extension lead that can be wheeled on by a lab technician like at school that he can refer to? And Jason made the interesting point that the bottle didn't specify whether the West Ham players had warmed up before taking their penalty, which obviously clearly very important. Three more games to go in the Premier League. Manchester City 2, Burnley 0. John Stones started for the first time this season. Manchester City just quietly going about their business. I mean, I liked how hard Bernardo Silva kicked the ball in from a yard. I have no other huge thoughts on this game unless somebody has some insight for us.
Well, the only thing is I think Burnley are a bit better in the position the table suggests. And I think, I mean, only losing 2-0 rather than the habitual 5-0 at City. Does that tell us anything? I don't know. But I thought they were better than they have been in that game in recent years. And I think they there will come a point.
They're too good to go down, Wilson.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that, but I think there will come a point where they start getting results before too long.
They had a few chances, didn't they? And Cornet was a player that I was surprised they were able to attract, and he's definitely started very well for them. Maybe they could do with another couple of that ilk, but I know I say every year that they're going down and then they make me look stupid. So I'm now hedging, but it was definitely an improvement from them.
Yeah, Maxwell Cornet has previous against City. He scored 3 goals in 2 games, or 4 in 3, I think, for Lyon. And he was through in a one-on-one against Zach Steffen and messed it up. And Chris Wood had a decent opportunity, which he put over the bar as well. So encouraging from Burnley.
Southampton got their first win of the season, 1-0 over Leeds. Armando Broja, a great goal on the break. I've been dreaming about this moment since I was 3, he said. It's very specific, isn't it? I can't remember any dreams that I had when I was 3. Probably one of the reasons why I didn't make it as a footballer.
But also, he's 20, not 40-odd.
Well, that is true.
So, he's 3 is relatively recent for him compared to you.
Right. I mean, I can't remember any dreams I had when I was 20.
Well, you're probably pissed.
Do you think he dreamt specifically about scoring a pretty straightforward tap-in against Leeds? Or just,
I think so, yeah.
Generally about scoring in the Premier League?
A breakaway goal in the 53rd minute on loan from Chelsea against
the
Leeds.
Cross from Nathan Redmond.
Yeah, I thought the finish was better than tap-in. But
okay, yeah.
Emphatic.
It was emphatic. Perfect, yeah. He was born in Slough, on loan from Chelsea, like every other footballer. If you're not sure, just presume they're on loan from Chelsea. and he plays for Albania. I'm a big fan of Ralph Hasenhüttl's looking like an uncle at a wedding or an usher. And Leeds had six players out, but are they under, you know, what are you thinking, Wilson? Are you worried about Bielsa? Have they burnt out?
Well, I mean, they should be worried, yeah, because, I mean, they six players out, and I think particularly Calvin Phillips and Rafinha are clearly hugely important players to them. Calvin Phillips especially, you know, his distribution, and I think England missed him against Hungary. The pace at which he plays the ball from back of midfield is crucial to how they play. Obviously, Rafinha's been their best attacking player this season. So to be out both of those is a huge loss. And so you can't blame them too much when they're missing two such key players. But only one win all season. And they're now in the bottom six. And of the other five teams in the bottom six, they have played four of them. So it's not that they've had especially hard fixtures. Is it a long-term problem? I don't know. But I mean, the thing you always worry about with Bielsa is that this is the longest he's ever been at a club. That his intensity does grind people down. Whether that's happened or not, I don't know. But you would have that doubt, certainly. But having said that, I assume when Phillips and Rafinha and Bamford and everybody are back and fit and Koch and Ayling, then yeah, they'll be okay.
You do think with Leeds, don't you, that although they've added to the squad in the last year or two with players like Rafinha, it has largely been the same group of players now, largely under Bielsa for what, about three seasons. So maybe it's just so then they need to refresh it more personnel wise.
Say the word, Nick. Say the word. Say burnout.
Knackered, Wilson. Knackered.
Finally, Norwich 0, Brighton 0. My only thought from this game was that chance for Josh Sargent, and just wondered, is maybe he can only kick it that hard, and it's a problem as a footballer, because it was. I mean, it was such a terrible attempt at scoring an open goal. I don't think
it was even going in.
No.
I think it was heading for the post, the foot of the far post. But it was a risible effort.
It felt like me trying to putt a golf ball, to be honest. Like that's what it reminded me of.
Do you think, with all the Jimmy Greaves tributes, there was a whole lot, he didn't blast it into the net. He liked to pass the ball into the net. Do you think that's infected the minds of young players? Are they trying to hit the ball too weakly now?
Well, maybe Josh Sargent loves the goal. One of my favourite goals is when the finish is slow enough that a defender can think they can get it, and then they end up tangled in the net. It's a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you have to get more on it than that. Because what was funny was, I can't remember which Brighton, I think it was Lewis Dunk cleared it. But he didn't need to clear it. But he just sort of felt, well, I'm going through the motions of clearing something off the line here, so I better just hoof it out of play. But basically, the ball had stopped. He could have just carried on playing. Anyway, a question that I forgot from the Manchester United game from Tragic, which is quite good. I don't want to get you started again, but
it's about the structure in midfield. There's problems there.
No, he just said after losing to Leicester, should Ole Gunnar Solskjaer prioritise his football and other on-field commitments rather than interfering with Marcus Rashford. That's very good. Anyway, that'll do for part two. We'll do any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Kerry says, if it's not 60 minutes talking about the South Wales derby, I will write a very stern letter to the man. Swansea 3, Cardiff 0. I apologise, Kerry, but you got 9 seconds of it, which, you know, is hopefully more than you were anticipating. Tony says, Luton won at Millwall for the first time since 99. Can the whole pod be donated to this, please? No, it can't. But once again, we have mentioned it. So I hope you're happy about that. We send our thoughts and best wishes to the friends and family of Trevor Hemmings, the Preston North End owner. Joseph says he was a local kid who saved us. We are financially stable, which was not the case when he took over. Match versus Derby was £5. All the gate receipts went to charity. Little bit the dream owner, he says.
Yeah, he was a huge horse racing enthusiast as well. His colours, green and yellow, were quite famous in jump racing. And they had the corner flags and at the game and those colours. And I think a load of the fans went wearing flat caps, which were kind of a trademark of Trevor Hemmings. Anytime you'd see him on a race course, he's always wearing a flat cap.
That may rest in peace. In the FA Cup, first round draw has been made. 8th tier AFC Sudbury, the lowest ranked side through to the FA Cup. First round have been drawn with Colchester. Is that a local derby or East Anglia, Nick?
Yeah, I will be dusting off my glamorous East Anglian correspondent credentials possibly for that one. I think it's about 12 miles apart, 15 miles apart. Yeah, there's a lot of, I think there's been quite a lot of connections between the two clubs in the past. Although Sudbury Giant killed Brighton actually a few years ago. I remember being about 12 or 13 and listening to it live commentary on Radio Suffolk as they beat Brighton on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. So great childhood memories coming back.
Sudbury and Marine are one of four 8th tier sides left in the competition. Greg Bukowski's Marine, of course. I'm not sure if he's still turning out for them, but you know, maybe he'll get a game. They played Spurs, didn't they? Was that last year or a year before? I can't remember.
I think it was last year.
Marske United and Pontefract Collieries face replays to make it through to the first round. Sam says, how long before Ronaldo imitates the Glentoran keeper and expels his bubbling, unearned displeasure rage? I'm thinking McTominay gets headbutted for overhitting a long ball while desperately attempting to find a last-minute equaliser against Atalanta. This is the Glentoran goalkeeper, Aaron McCary, responding to Coleraine's equaliser by taking out teammate Bobby Burns and getting sent off. It's Barry, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, he just decked him, basically. And the thing I couldn't understand, the guy he punched didn't seem to have done anything wrong. I wasn't quite sure why he was the particular subject of the goalkeeper's ire. But yeah, it's one of those things you don't want to see, but you secretly love to see.
Mm. When Cambridge lost 6-0 away at Brentford one year, in the years where we played Brentford, Paul Rayner was sent off for headbutting Mick Heathcote, which was a good moment too. Our two players with moustaches, just one chinning the other, was nice to see. Gareth says, I love the football chat, but I've started looking forward more to the butternut squash, parking lot, batting defensively to hold on for a draw, etc. stories. So no question from me, just a request for everyone, including you, Max, to share a mundane highlight from the last few days. Wilson, a mundane, a banal thing that's happened to you in the last few days.
I got a new rug delivered on Friday, and it's beautiful. It's brought the room together.
Oh, wow. Where's the rug from?
Iran.
Okay, and
imported via Sweden. Okay. At some expense.
Got a work permit? Has it played 75% of the games for Iran?
It has a certificate of authentication. Okay. I know you're a massive rug fan, so you realise what a big deal this is. It's 90,000 knots per square metre.
Okay, wow. Sounds like quite fast for a rug, doesn't it?
it's not a flying carpet. It's like...
And how much was the rug, Wilson? You're not going to tell us.
I don't answer that question.
Was it, more than £1,000?
No.
Okay.
But it was very close to £1,000.
Is it £900?
It was £995, okay?
Wow.
Fuck, you got out of
a lot for a rug.
I have a rug here in my room which I basically bought under extreme duress in India. And I think if I hadn't bought it, I would still be in the shop. 3 years old. So I didn't really want it. But... Yep. It cost me, I think, the thick end of £90 to just to get it sent over. I had to pay duty on it, rug duty, which I wasn't aware of at the time.
Rug duty is what, you know, police officers get sent on when they've done something wrong, isn't it? What are you doing, Jeff? I'm on rug duty. And could you describe it? Could you describe it for us, Barry?
It's a rug. It's rectangle shaped.
Yeah,
it's got tassels at each end. It's maroonish in colour with a nice intricate design.
See, tassels at each end. Mine is a classic Iranian rug. Only has tassels at one end. Oh, right. This is something I've learned about in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Do you have the tassels by the telly or the other end of the?
Well, to the left of the telly, the window end, if you will.
And when I got my rug sent over. Because I was away in India, I had it delivered to my local pub. Okay, and the landlady very unkindly refused to pay the £90 duty with which So he's ended up in a depot in Croydon somewhere. And the hoops I had to jump through to get this fucking rug.
How big is it?
It's about the size of a pool table, I suppose. A bit bigger, maybe.
Oh, okay. So size, but, yeah,
7 by 7 foot by 4.
7 by 4. Okay.
Nick, rugs. Anything?
I've got a lovely rug just to my left. To my shame, I can't remember if it's either from John Lewis or Heels or someone like that. I should know.
Somebody's doing all right for themselves.
I'm probably John Lewis. It's nicely stitched. Always very careful when vacuuming it because you don't want it flaying up, do you? And
no, that's a good point.
Which is an absolute hazard. So always careful not to drop too much on it.
Are you hoovering it with a Henry or a Dyson Airblade? Dyson Airblade.
That's a hand dryer. That's a hand dryer.
Honestly, I can't get anything up in that. I'm moving it around my house. Trying to hoover it, just blowing everything everywhere. Honestly. Sorry, Nick, I was interrupted you. Hoover have you got?
That's absolutely fine, Max. It's a Dyson.
Okay, marvellous. Okay, well, that's great. Finally, I hope that was enough for you, Gareth. I feel like we've probably... it's a deep dive into rugs. Paul says, is it just me or does the kid in the new Home Alone movie bear an uncanny resemblance to Barry? Absolutely spot on. And well done on making your movie debut there. You're playing the kid, Barry.
Well, he's a hard-drinking 50-year-old, right? Who smokes 20 a day?
It's an interesting take.
I wasn't aware there was a new Home Alone movie.
Aisling B and Rob Delaney, and you're the kid.
Is it a remake?
Yeah, it's a remake, yeah.
What? Why?
Well, I don't imagine. They just thought, a production company thought they'd remake Home Alone. Then they got it signed off. Then the actors agreed to do it. And then they filmed it. And now they're putting it out.
That's a big shout because they'll do well to make a better version than the original.
Anyway, producer Joel's put a picture of the young boy in the WhatsApp group. If you'd like to look at your phone to see what you look like.
Is that a super soaker he's carrying as well?
It is, yeah.
I think it is.
You should sue them. They've ripped off your life.
That's harsh.
It looks a bit like Roland from Grange Hill as well.
It does look a bit like Roland from Grange Hill as well. There we are. Anyway, that I feel should do enough for today. Wilson, thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
Barry, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Wednesday, Champions League week.
This is The Guardian.